You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
It is time for Dear Science indeed, and what a lovely afternoon it is for some science. Well, not that lovely, I suppose. It's a bit dreary outside.
It is. Welcome back, Caster. Goodness
yeah,
me.
Yeah. Cool. Not for
welcome back, both of you.
Not for long, but I'll be filling in this week, and I'm pretty familiar with some science, but not these stories.
Okay.
So I'll need you to fill us all in.
Okay, I shall do my best.
Yeah, so the Voyager 1, we've heard about the Voyager 1 a few times before.
Yeah, we have.
But
yeah,
it's going through a bit of trouble, or it has been, right?
you're right. We do tend to talk a little bit about Voyager 1 because it is astonishing. So just, you know, for a bit of background, 48 years and 3 days ago it was launched. So this was back when Jimmy Carter was still president of the USA. Yeah. Muldoon was prime minister of New Zealand,
yeah,
you know.
A good while ago.
A wee while ago. I'm probably about the only person in the building currently who remembers that, probably, I'm guessing. So this was launched, as I say, in 1977, 815 kilos. So that puts it about the size of a small car. And at the moment, it is a mind-boggling 25 billion kilometres away. 25 billion kilometres away.
So for context, how far are, you know, planets in our solar system?
We're well past them.
Right.
We are and truly past
well
them.
Well past, got it.
And we are travelling, or it is travelling at 17 kilometres a second.
Jeez, that's quite fast.
Which means it can go around the world in 40 minutes. Okay, so it's moving.
Yeah.
It's moving. And at the present time, it takes almost a day. It's about 23 hours for radio signals traveling at the speed of light to reach it. So, you know, it's a hell of a long way away. It's an astonishing piece of human ingenuity.
Yeah.
Just incredible. Now, in 2012, it basically got sort of to the far reaches of our solar system. So it was sort of getting to the point where it crossed a thing called the heliopause. And the heliopause is kind of where our solar system ends and sort of interstellar space begins, sort of roughly. Okay, so it's where the sun's influence sort of ends, let's say.
Yeah.
And interstellar space begins. And so we didn't know a lot about what things were like out there, because you sort of think, well, space, it's big, it's dark, it's cold, not a heck of a lot happening out there. And by cold, we're sort of talking about negative 270 degrees
about
Celsius.
About close to as cold as it gets.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So that was sort of the feeling that, out there, it's, you know, there's not going to be a heck of a lot happening. So, but NASA have just released new data while they can before they get shut down by those, you know, intellectual luminaries who are in charge of the USA at the moment.
Yeah.
But these new data that NASA found, it shows that Voyager 1 is currently experiencing temperatures, excuse me, and I say that in inverted commas, between 30,000 and 50,000 degrees Celsius.
And that's probably not what it was designed for, I'd imagine.
No, indeed not. And that's extraordinarily hot in our sort of sense of the word, the way that we would perceive heat.
Right, but for the Voyager,
It's a bit different. The way that we perceive heat relies on the fact that our atmosphere is full of stuff, let's say.
Right.
So molecules of air that can, molecules of oxygen, nitrogen in the air that can basically transmit heat, okay,
right,
by convection, okay. And they don't have that out in outer space.
No, nothing there.
There's pretty much nothing there. There's not nothing.
Right.
There's pretty much nothing, though, okay?
Got it. Okay.
But even so, what they are seeing, or what Voyager 1 is seeing, is these supposed temperatures of 30 to 50,000 degrees Celsius. And these arise as a result of these extraordinarily energetic particles, charged particles that are coming from the sun, and they seem to be hitting matter, of which there's not a heck of a lot, out in the interstellar region, okay? So there's interstellar material out there. Again, not a lot of it, so these collisions are not exactly
happening. Big, funny rocks and
very,
that sort of thing.
Very, well, more like tiny particles and stuff, really.
Okay,
okay?
Right.
So we're talking sort of tiny particles colliding with tiny particles. But these collisions have huge, huge energy. And if this was sort of translated into sort of the conditions in our atmosphere and everything, then we would be looking at these ridiculously high temperatures of 30 to 50,000 degrees Celsius. So basically, this has caused maybe a rethink of what we think is actually going on out there. So, you know, the idea was that it was a very, very cold and boring place. But these data seem to say, right, well, no, that's absolutely not the case.
Might be hot and boring.
Well, it's, you know, it's very, very violent collisions, and it's a turbulent place, perhaps more so than the very dull and boring place that they thought.
Yeah, and we know there's stuff on the Voyager, right? That's my first concern, right? What's going to happen to all of our stuff?
All of our stuff?
Yeah.
In terms of...
Well, it's quite hot. Does the heat
But that's the beauty of it, right. that it's there's not enough of these collisions that getting that particular heat. But you know, translating it to our conditions, yes, it would. It would be really hot. Yeah. But there's so few of these collisions.
It's not actually.
They are very, very violent. Okay, and they would give temperatures like that. So, you know, maybe we're going to have to rethink our ideas of what deep space means, and we've just got to keep making the most of Voyager until it's basically going to die around 2036, they reckon. So that's when the power supply is just not going to be sufficient to keep it all running. They've turned off instruments already, so it's running on its bare bones at the moment, and it's telling us all these incredible things about a place that we just can't even imagine. So incredible stuff, absolutely incredible stuff.
And then this next story, breakfast impacting life expectancy. We call it the most important meal of the day.
We do,
right?
We do.
But maybe even more important than we thought before.
Indeed. And this, I guess, you often sort of with these stories wonder how people get the idea to study these sorts of things. And this is another one, you know, the timing of your meals. Who would think that the timing of your meals would make a difference to anything?
To life expectancy of all things as well.
Absolutely. Well, thankfully some workers in the UK, the USA, and Turkey have got together, and that's what they studied. They thought, okay, let's have a look at the timing of meals and let's see what impact this has. And, you know, this is just one of a squillion variables that are out there of things that you could study that may or may not have an effect on life expectancy and stuff. And basically what they found in a nutshell was that there's a possible link between the overall health status of older people and, believe it or not, the time that they have breakfast.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Which is amazing. And you might think, oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is a little study, pseudoscience.
Yeah.
Well, okay, have I got news for you? So they studied 2,945 older people, so ages 42 to 94. get this, over a 20-year period. 20 years.
Wow, long study.
Yeah.
20
so
years.
So we've got a whole pile of evidence.
Yeah. So this is not just sort of a flash in the pan study. This is over a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
With a lot of people, you know, basically 3,000 people. And so their major findings. Okay, so they find that as people age, they tend to eat later. Okay. And so particularly breakfast and dinner.
Yeah.
Okay, so they tend to have breakfast later in the morning. They tend to have dinner later at night. Okay. And as people age, okay, so those having breakfast later were consistently found to have problems with depression and fatigue and with oral health.
Wow.
Oh, okay. That's quite interesting.
Bad oral health.
It's quite a trend these days. There's a lot of anti-breakfast people. Yeah. Intermittent fasting, whatever it is, like, oh, it's good breakfast, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's a thing. How does that tie into it in some way?
Well, they'll probably need another 20-year study to figure
that out.
Yeah.
I would guess, but, you know, this is basically it. This is a well-carried-out, long-term study, which, you know, has given results which are fairly probably incontrovertible, really.
Yeah.
So, and the late breakfasters over everything have an increased risk of death.
And that's really unfortunate news, because I'm personally a late breakfaster a lot of the time. Yeah. I wake up quite late some days, but I always have my breakfast.
Well,
and now I'm concerned.
Wow. I was going to say, no more brunching.
You need more 8 o'clock lectures, obviously.
Yeah.
to get you up. I'm hoping not. So, you know, the people who are what they call night owls, so the people who are late to bed,
yes,
late to rise,
yeah,
they're going to be in danger. You know,
that's me.
That's me as well.
They tend to eat meals at later times.
This is a wake-up call.
Yeah.
And so they are more at risk. So, you know, as you say, what can we do about this? What would be wise to do in this case with these results? Mm. And basically encourage older adults to have consistent meal schedules and, you know, don't breakfast late. You know, get up, you know, nice and early or whatever. Mm. Have your breakfast at a consistent time. Have your dinner at a consistent time. And that seemed to be the thing, that consistency and timing were seemingly important with basically your overall health. So
Incredible stuff. Who would have thunk it?
You know?
Wow. And then
Certainly not me.
This last thing, nuclear fusion and palladium metal, where do we even start?
Oh, yes. Well, speaking back to 1977 in the first story, we go back to 1989 now, and I'm still probably the only person in the building that can remember 1989.
Yeah, you might be.
I would think. Which is, anyway, there was this thing called cold fusion, which was all the rage those days.
We still talk about it.
Oh, we do, we do. And this was the most public example of scientists being so wrong. Absolutely,
right.
absolutely wrong. And the reason that they were so wrong was that if they were right, then the riches that would have occurred for them would have just been unimaginable. Instant Nobel Prize.
Got it.
And you'd probably be richer than, you know, probably most people on the planet, because this was going to be basically free energy out of a bucket of water. That was that was essentially the guts of it.
That's quite big.
That you could power the Earth on a bucket of water, basically.
Wow.
And that was because you were going to be replicating what's happening in the middle of the sun, this process called fusion.
Right. Yeah.
Okay? Which normally needs incredibly high pressures and incredibly high temperatures in order to occur.
But instead we're going to do it cold?
And they were claiming that they could do it at room temperature.
Wow. How do they get it wrong right now? I'm wondering.
They didn't measure their temperature correctly. They didn't they didn't stir their solution, apparently, while this reaction, whatever, was going on.
Right.
And that meant that the thermometer they used had sort of, it was just measuring hot spots. And they were saying, oh, look, we're getting out more heat than we're putting in, and so therefore it must be nuclear fusion and blah, 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 blah. And what they were using was this metal called palladium.
Yes.
And they were sort of filling it full of hydrogen gas or deuterium gas, which is a form of hydrogen. And they proposed that for some reason that these guys would get so, so close together under such high pressure in this palladium metal that they'd get so close, and then they would just fuse and give off lots of heat. Anyway, they were proven wrong. However, you have a quick look around the internet and there are still people who say, oh, yes, this is right,
cold
this is absolutely right.
Possible.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, absolutely. So a bunch of scientists in Canada have shown, yes, actually, you can.
We can do it.
You can do it.
And we've solved it. We've solved the energy crisis.
Well, no, you haven't. No, you haven't. So one of the things that was required of this was excess heat. In other words, you get out more heat than you put in.
Yes.
The other thing that was required was neutrons.
Neutrons.
If this fusion reaction was going, you should get these things called neutrons ejected, which are neutral particles that are part of the nucleus, and they should come flying out at high speeds, which wouldn't have been good for you. You probably would have, you know, irradiated yourself with neutrons, and that's never good. But these Canadian team has basically done a very, very similar thing. They've used palladium metal, they've pumped it full of deuterium, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they have found that they see neutrons. Okay, and so that's a pretty good,
seems like a good indicator.
Marker
yeah.
that this is actually happening. Okay, now before everybody gets way too excited,
I'm getting a little bit excited.
Remember, we need to get out more energy than we're putting in.
Yes.
Okay. So in this,
so output does not equal input. Well, no, not in this case.
Well usually, usually, surely, isn't output less than input? I feel like
yes, absolutely.
That's
it
one
is.
Of the laws of energy.
That
though.
Is the law of thermodynamics. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So they are putting in 15 watts
and
they're getting out 10 to the minus 9 of a watt.
That seems like quite a lot less.
So that's about 100 billion fold less. Okay.
Right.
So, we're basically not solving the energy crisis like this. I think what they've done is that they've shown that there is an unusual process going on. It's only 15% higher than background, so that, you know, what they're seeing is a tiny, tiny, tiny effect. It's very, very small. It's nowhere near what would be required to do this. But basically it's saying that, yep, there is something funny going on here. This is probably worth more study, which I'm absolutely sure they will do. Mm. And this, as opposed to 1989, is a good piece of science, okay? And the problem in 1989 was, as I say, it was all to do with the money side of things, that they would have got unimaginable riches. And the problem was that there were two groups who were competing at the time. And somebody had to be first. Now, normally when you announce a scientific breakthrough, you publish it.
Yes.
You write a manuscript, you send it to a journal, it goes through peer review, they say yay or nay, blah de blah de blah. This was way too important for that, so they announced it at a press conference.
Wow.
Wrong thing to do. Wrong thing to
Especially if you're wrong.
Yes, yes, indeed. Mm. And sadly, the names Pons and Fleischmann, and they were both, you know, they were both basically sort of stand-up scientists and stuff, but they just got it horribly, horribly wrong. And, Don't do that. Don't let money be the ruler.
All right. Well, Cold Fusion, maybe not out of the books yet, but definitely not what it's all cracked up to be. And as with Dear Science, we can expect maybe some further things to find out.
Oh, we always follow up on Dear Science. Yeah. Hell yes.
And it'll be exciting to hear, not with me, but with Sarah, which will be exciting for you guys to hear in 2 weeks when you're back. All right. Well, thank you, Alan, for joining us today. Thank you, Mota, as always. And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.